staff and wastewater capital management regarding wastewater opportunity.
We're going to learn how to make a silk purse out of a cow's excrement.
That is much more eloquent than the phrases we've been batting around in the investment suite.
The record show that I haven't seen Todd this excited on the board.
Perfect timing.
Yes.
So you have a recommendation in front of you from staff for a $25 million commitment to the Wastewater Opportunity Fund. Previewed this for the board last week. It fits our real asset allocation budget. Areas of interest that we identified last November that we were likely to pursue. We talked about a potential $20 to $30 million commitment to the waste or water space. This nicely fits both. It's primarily a waste opportunity. It's backed by real assets. Anaerobic digesters the cash flows are unique in that the off-takers of the methane under long-term take-or-pay contracts, something we're accustomed to seeing with our power funds. Much of the income is contractually in place before the projects break ground, and we think it fits, it's appropriate, and it has upside in terms of what we could possibly do with the water effluent in the future. Right now, it'll be discharged to wastewater treatment plants. After we've taken the methane off and the compost and the solids have precipitated out as compost. But the potential for the future is for the water to be reused in some marketable fashion. Not probably likely within the lifespan of this fund, but it gets us in the habit of talking about those issues and getting us up to speed with the potential off-takers of the water for future. Because we don't know how long the drought's going to last. So. I'll let Chi-Chi walk through our analysis here.
So this is a unique opportunity to make our real asset portfolio more complete. It's unique in the sense that the digester development market is very local. So it's hard to find an institutional caliber investor like Equilibrium. And Tim has been following real asset for years. So last year, he sent me to their educational conference in San Francisco. And that's how we learned about this opportunity. So we have been following with the fund and opportunity since then. In terms of making our real asset more complete, if you can please go to page 8 of the staff memo. That risk and return spectrum profile is what we have right now. And with this $25 million commitment, if you look at page 9, the blue one in the middle, this is what we will be look like in the future. So as you can see, this opportunity will fill the void in the middle of the risk return spectrum. And we will come back to this chart later to tie this investment more tightly with other investments. So what the fund does is actually very relatable to our daily lives. If you look at page 2, this is the investment strategy and their process. So they take the waste people don't want, but they need to get rid of. Like Scott, what you like to say, it's the law. So this is what we face, the problem right now. You cannot dump in the landfill anymore. Landfill is very hard to find. And then we take this human and animal and wastewater into the digester tank. And they went through the fermentation process. And what comes out is usable energies. And what makes this simple process very special are three things. First, they can produce electricity or gas or biofuel.
The digestion tank, is that, how is that constructed? Is that a metal tank? Is it in the ground? What is that?
Metal tank above ground.
That's it there.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And useful life is very long. It's like 30 years. So what makes it special is they can produce electricity or gas or biofuel. So they can have all three. For example, if you look at solar or wind, they cannot produce gas or biofuel. Of course, they are not competing to each other. They each have their own carve out in the renewable energy space. And secondly is they can storage the gas very cheaply. If you go to East Bay Ma plant, for example, sometimes you see the flame going out. So that's burning the gas because they don't have the space to storage. So that's money into the air. And the last one is they can generate the electricity at the peak hours. So this way they can charge a premium for electricity. And if you look at the process one, when you take the waste from the trucks, you actually charge tipping fees. So I cannot think about any of our investment that when you take the raw materials, you get paid by doing that. So this is very unique. So on both ends, you get paid by taking in the waste and by producing the energy and contract them out.
Can I ask a question? Sure. I don't know if this, if you want the whole presentation, just it's a fairly new, you know, anaerobic digestion is working. My understanding is, for example, at East Bay Mud site, they're using the fuel that they produce to run their own plant, but they're not selling it at this point. Are there anaerobic digesters out there where they actually are selling, you know, generating electricity, generating fuel that they're selling on a secondary market?
Yes, on both. For the East Bay Ma, Jeff and I, we actually went there a couple of months ago. So right now they are generating 130% of the electricity
that they needed.
Yeah. Right. So 100% they use by themselves. Uh-huh. So that's $3 million a year for the rate payer savings. The other 30% they actually sell it to the Port of Oakland.
Okay, so they are selling it now to the Port of Oakland. Okay, previously they hadn't, at least when they were negotiating with the Central Contra Costa Solid Waste Authority, because that was one of our discussion items, but they are. Okay.
And right, the fact that you have both those channels available, you can sell it back to who you're co-located with for their energy production or refueling a truck fleet. You can build a pipeline, sell it into the renewable energy channel. You have optionality there about who the off-taker is. But I think the important thing is we have a long-term contract for a sizable portion of that before we break ground. So you've got a co-location that's easy to take the raw material in. You've got a contract for the off-taker that meets renewable energy. We really look at this as a bridge between two regulatory issues. On the, you can't dump the waste, demands a premium, and somebody needs renewable energy on this side, and this is a nice little bridge in the middle.
And is Wastewater Opportunity Fund involved with the East Bay Mud project at all?
They weren't, this
is just an example.
Right. We're looking at this as being the first larger scale commercial platform is going to roll these out. I mean, these exist across the United States in an ad hoc basis, individual utilities, individual farms, that sort of thing. This is the first one that's going to become the third-party platform to roll these out with a clustering effect of putting these in one location or one area that can be collected into the gas can be sold to, you know, an off-taker. So developing some economies of scale around this rather than having this be project by project on a very disparate basis. There's going to be an attempt to aggregate these.
To aggregate, but that creates so many other permitting regulatory issues if it hasn't been tried before. Is it at all in your due diligence speculative? The science is there, but knowing how challenging it is to even get a grinder permitted, you know, to process it, it makes me a little nervous, particularly in the California's CEQA environment.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we can obviously have the folks from Wastewater talk about their permitting expertise there. They have put these plants up in predecessor funds. They've got experience on the permitting side. It's going to be a risk. Permitting is, you know, I view this as a little bit of
There is additional operational risk embedded here. We're seeing less technological risk, certainly, mm-hmm. a little bit more operational risk. We're trying something new. Broadly speaking, this falls under my internal heading of kind of an R&D mm-hmm. type of thing. From our perspective, it's something that we're trying something new. It's a segment that we're interested in. We, our proposed sizing of the investment reflects the fact that it's not proven out. We think it's an intriguing idea that's appropriate for Sisera at a relatively modest allocation because of some of these permitting issues. We need to see this proven out. If they were on Fund 3 and had a proven track record, this could be a more material allocation. This is a, we find the idea intriguing, we see some operational issues, we see some scale issues, but we think there's enough upside there that warrants pursuing this, and we'll see how everything plays out there. They have gone, they do have project expertise of getting these permitted.
Yeah. And to go back to your question, that's why they only do this in targeted states.
Uh-huh. In what states?
Basically, West Coast targeted. And Northeast.
Yeah, okay.
Right. They, you know, for example, some state may have a lot of animals waste.
Right.
But, you know, there's no environment to support that. But in, for example, in California, the mandate is pretty
right.
big.
Well, we have a very high diversion.
Right.
Yeah.
So
right
you need to be
2020. But.
Right. You need to be getting 50% of your energy from renewable source by 2050 or 2030, I forgot the number.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a big drive
okay.
on those targeted states to get this done.
Yeah.
Question about the business model. What is the contractual basis that the fund expects its investment to be able to secure feedstock with? In other words, you've got multiple, it looked like you had multiple lines of feedstock here. You've got sort of traditional industrial wastewater, you're looking at food waste, kind of a market, which could be is commercial and residential, and then whatever else, you know, cow fields. What is the assessment of the ability to secure the waste stream, the feedstock flow contractually to finance these facilities?
And that's why they pay very close attention when they select the site. For example, we just went to a conference in Orlando, and there is a site there to get the waste, a lot of food waste from Disneyland and surrounding hotels. So they are going to pick a site very strategically to make sure there is a good mix of the intake from for their plant.
Yeah. Okay, so using Disneyland, in California, Disneyland is in the city of Anaheim, right?
Right.
So that entire area is governed by the city of Anaheim's exclusive franchise agreement with its solid waste provider, who has the secured right to that waste stream now.
Right.
So it's not available to the market to go to some other facility that might be developed. So I'm trying to understand, is this an open market kind of an investment where the goal is to site a facility in an area where the market is not subject to exclusive franchise agreements or other contractual commitments that have already spoken for that waste stream?
Yeah, if there is no source for them to take in those waste, they will not pick a site there.
Yeah, and I think maybe one important distinction here is we're talking about wastewater streams, not solid waste streams. The wastewater stream is primarily going to the municipal facilities, not to privately held areas. So if it's going into a municipal stream and they're charging a premium, a diversion is appropriate for both parties. I think there's economic alignment there. These folks can talk about the regulatory environment. Obviously not my area of expertise. We will bring them in and talk about that. But when you're going through that municipal channel, and the municipal channel is already charging your premium to accept that waste stream because of its organic content or its acidity or alkalinity, having that divert to a third party where the effluent is now, you know, when the effluent comes off the anaerobic digester, it's basically wastewater that can go into the municipal wastewater stream without a premium associated with it. So there's economic alignment on both sides of that. It's not damaging to the municipal wastewater system, and somebody saves money by not paying as high of a tipping fee or as high of a premium for the disposal.
Yeah, I was trying to get the linkage between the pitch part of the fund, which is, hey, we've got AB 1826 coming down the pipeline. Cities and counties throughout the state are going to have to be able to comply, and they're going to have a spoken solution for their organics waste stream. Most cities and counties around the state, and I know Supervisor Anderson can speak to this, have been way out in front on this, trying to plan for that, whether it be through, as we have here, a joint powers authority that governs a lot of this, or cities and counties individually governing it. So I was trying to understand the linkage, the AB 1826 linkage, between the idea that waste stream is going to be available to serve this. Is this solely industrial wastewater?
No. I think a lot of the examples of things that they've talked about doing, particularly in Oregon and Washington, has been co-locating on large dairies. Taking that waste stream, which is, you know, there's some obviously solid waste coming off dairy farms, but there's a sizable portion of liquid waste.
Right.
Co-locating there on site of the private property, taking that waste stream, going through this process and selling off the methane or the gas generated. We've also taken a look at, you know, there's a potential for breweries who have a large component of organic waste stream coming off them. You know, breweries use a lot of water, and there's a lot of organic waste when it comes off there, co-locating with them, that sort of thing. So single-sided, one credit underwriting type of an approach here. You've got one entity, you site it on their property, you take care of their particular issue, and then the waste stream can go out to a municipal source, rather than doing aggregation across the city, county, that sort of thing. This is more of a diverting a single, large, significant waste stream.
Yeah, I would think, just given that expected capital cost of this type of facility, that you would have to have a fairly large producer to do a cogeneration model with, where you're going to have the power produced feed that operation and then sell the excess to the market.
Think of this as the sweet spot here: huge dairy farms, huge breweries. These are large producers of organic waste streams. The Disney example, I think, is a little bit unique, probably not the sweet spot here. But you've got folks who produce on a daily basis, where their production cycle is somewhat tied to GDP, but it's relatively, you know, inelastic demand. These things they're always going to be producing. So you talk about having long-term stability on the input side. Dairy farms generally maintain their headcount. Cattle farms have a varying headcount of cattle. Right. Dairy farms generally maintain a higher degree of stability there. Breweries, for better or worse, keep making beer,
yes,
kind of regardless
they do.
Of the economic environment. But these waste streams coming off of those two, I think, would be the exemplars of what we're trying to capture here and provide a solution for.
And you made a right call on using Anaheim, but for their pipeline, I don't see they have the area as the potential investment, but they do have some opportunities in Sacramento area and the Phoenix area.
So for me, most dairy farms are out in the valley, Modesto, Escalon, Manteca, out that way. The large urban centers that would use the gas produced from these are Sacramento, maybe, you know, and then the Bay Area. Those are, you know, and that's, there's a significant difference between those areas. Is it pipelines that there will be, that they would install after?
We have that.
To feed into those urban areas?
Yeah, pipeline is part of the construction cost.
It is part of their construction cost?
You have the option of doing a small-scale co-location power generation to feed the energy needs. As TG mentioned, with EV Mud, they're producing their own electricity on-site. They're burning that gas running the generators on-site, producing their own electricity, and feeding some of it back into the grid, into the Port of Oakland. That's an option. You can burn it on-site, feed it back into the grid. You don't necessarily need a pipeline to go to an existing power plant. To the extent they get a cluster that has economies of scale, they can then build that pipeline and sell it back in to a PG&E, to Southern California Edison, that sort of thing. We've got multiple channels here. I mean, the core of this is you have a negative cost of input, you have a positive cost of output. You have siting and regulatory risk. Those are the kind of the big risks here. You also have exit risk. How are we going to sell these in the future? But the operating piece of this to us is a relatively straightforward approach.
I have another one more question with regards to investments. What is the, according to our policy, what is the maximum amount of percentage that we can have in any one fund?
In any one fund, we've got a 10% limit, 10% of the corpus. So
10%.
$700 million.
This is asking for 12.5%.
No.
It's 20%.
The limitation is the percentage of our fund in any single.
Gotcha.
Investment. We have a
gotcha.
Practice.
And that's way, okay.
We have a practice of wanting to be 10% or less of a fund.
Of our fund, that's right.
We routinely override that when we're talking about limited partnerships if we want a sizable piece of this, because it's, you know, it's dependent upon what other folks do. We size our piece appropriate to what we're talking about doing.
I just want to make sure we're within our policy.
We don't have a specific policy on that. We have a practice and a goal. There's not a specific policy around what piece of an individual fund we can be.
Okay, now you're texting my memory. But if when Bob was here, for some reason I'm always remembering that 5% of our fund was the maximum amount of money that we wanted to put in any one investment.
10% typically was the way Bob thought about it. That was a practice that Milliman communicated to this board. It was never codified in a policy.
Really?
For this board.
Wow. We may need policy around that.
John,
that means we could jump to...
We could be 100% of a limited partnership that felt like the right thing, and we are. We are 100% of the Sigula Guff Cicera Opportunities Fund. It was a separate account that we thought felt was appropriate, and this board approved.
Okay.
I wanted, it's sort of a two-piece question. First, what is it we own when we put money into this fund? More explanation on that. I assume it's equity as opposed to fixed income, and then equity quite in what? And the second is, there are 2 and 20. One of the things that strikes me on 2% annually and 20% of profits is that these are, for the most part, non-liquid. So I'm assuming that what they would do is they would determine how it has appreciated each year and then take 20% of that. That's a very uncomfortable description to me. So if I misunderstand that, obviously explain it, but if not, talk about that.
2% on the committed capital, that's your kind of your fixed point in time. 20% is on actual generated proceeds when they sell, when we have a fixed valuation. The only two points where we have perfect clarity on the valuation are entry points and exit points. Everything else in between is an accounting exercise. They're not getting a 20% carry on that accounting exercise.
Right. Yeah, they cannot get it on the market.
So the other part was to go back and talk more about what it is we would own.
Equity stakes in individual projects.
Then the projects are all to be constructed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Gary. I know the risks on page 9 are not presented in any particular order, but one that popped up because it's somewhat ill-defined is the interest rate risk. It suggests that this become less attractive, if you will, with a significant rise in interest rates. So would you define for us significant? Is that 100 basis points? Is it 200 basis points? When does this become a factor? Significant, just a little too amorphous for me.
Yeah, let me think through this. We're talking about generating, they're underwriting 16 to 18% gross returns on these with an 8% current cash flow. I think that 8% current cash flow is the relative number, is the relevant number there.
Gut feeling, 300 basis point rise. Jeff?
The interest rate risk is relevant to switching from a construction loan to an operating asset loan.
Yeah.
So part of the way they exit the opportunity is once they get a construction loan to build the digester, mm-hmm. once that is built, they can refinance that.
Which is leads to the last point then, the last bullet point, which is what does it cost for them to change the model?
Once they have steady cash flow, and you can see this from our investment with EIF, the Energy Investor Fund.
So if we were to see over the course of time a 300 basis point change in interest rates, it might start creating some factors.
I think it would take the refinancing option probably off the table. It does not take the sale option off the table.
But that 300 basis points is not that far out. I mean, it is looking at today.
No, and I would not count on refinancing to be the primary route of exit.
Yeah.
We don't count on refinancing to be the primary route of exit on any of our investments. It happens to be there as an option today because if you have current cash flow and you can refi at these very low rates, it's attractive. It's attractive. You pull your money out. this is private equity. Sale should be the central thesis we're talking about here. Actually selling these on the open market to a natural buyer. Not everything else is kind of gravy that we could potentially see as alternative exit strategies along the way.
And how critical, I guess, if you could define it, would be that commodity pricing shift? Is that anyone we enter into an agreement, or not we, but the fund enters into an agreement, is going to be looking to hedge their bet for some period of time.
And that's where the commodity risk comes in, is that once the contract is signed, if the gas price goes up, you know, we lose the upside.
Right.
Yeah, that's the risk.
And that's what I mean by hedging. I mean, if I were them, I'd want to lock this in at a very low rate for a very long time, and then we can't see a change.
But then they're entering into a contract. The terms of the contract at that time will make the make it profitable. So,
and you're talking about the offtake of the methane?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the offtake of the methane, yes, you're tied to the commodity gas price, but remember, this is classified as a renewable resource. We have utilities who are required to meet targets. And again, when I talk about bridging the gap between two regulatory environments, we have, you know, municipal waste stream or wastewater treatment facilities that can't accept things either because of regulatory risk or damage to their actual equipment, and utilities who have this goal of accepting more renewable electricity or generating more electricity from renewable resources. And page 3 kind of talks about, you know, we're not pricing this off gas, we're pricing this as, you know, it's got a premium associated with it because it's helping you to meet your renewable energy requirements.
Might be better if I pose the other questions to the other guys, but I was interested, is it just primarily because of the regulatory requirements and condition that these are not, you don't see these in the middle of the country? Because I saw something one time Arkansas is just, no pun intended, awash with static ponds, swine ponds that are sitting out there and leaking. So I just don't see why there's nothing in there in Arkansas and Texas and places where you would think they'd be BS rich.
So since somebody picked on Iowa a couple weeks ago, I'm going to go ahead and pick on Iowa. I come from farm country, and the environmental regulations are lax to non-existent at best in the Midwest. The regulations around what can be discharged into the groundwater are largely non-existent. So simply having these in open ponds is a viable economic solution. Land is cheap. The regulations aren't there. So they're talking about concentrating the projects northeast, west coast. Land is expensive. Environmental regulation is strong. You're taking advantage of that, those two conditions there.
But down the line, it may in fact be a growth area.
I wouldn't count on it, but it's possible.
And last dumb question, poultry. Why doesn't it lend itself to, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into this subject, but is there something about poultry effluent?
I feel like a rim shot was needed there, but.
I know, but I'm because I. You know.
Solid waste versus liquid waste. shall we say. That would be my gut feeling. Let's let the experts.
Okay, I'll save my CS questions for them.
There we go.
It's the content.
I'm sorry?
It's the content.
I wondered if it's in a higher ammonia or something like that, some kind of a problem. Maybe Todd.
We signed our contract with Wurtz?
No. Momentarily.
Okay.
So bring him in?
Bring him in, thank you.
All right.
I just drove down I-5 recently, and they could use something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You would think that would be a perfect
about
spot.
About 20 miles off. You know, it's like, we're getting close.
Okay, yeah.
I think that would be a perfect spot. Wow. Those are big feedlots.
What is, what's that restaurant?
Harris Ranch.
Harris Ranch, there it is, yeah.
I think they're upwind.
Yeah. 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 None of the Harris Ranch. Yeah, yeah.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, God. That's terrible.
It was.
Yeah, really. You have about 30 minutes
all of your children.
To walk through your program and kind of how it works and what to expect from it, the concerns, the benefits.
Great, Brian, thank you.
We'll probably ask questions, so let you go.
Well, I very much appreciate being here, or we very much appreciate being here, and all the hard work everybody's done at Contra Costa to really get to understand our strategy. We love an interactive audience, so as interactive as you want to be, that's perfect for us, and we will aim to fit right in the time frame here. Just maybe in way of background of who we are individually, my name is Jay Pierpont. I've been with the firm for a little over 3 years, and I am a principal on the Wastewater Opportunity Fund, I'm very involved on the investment side of on managing risk and the disposition of the assets here. So really very much on the investment side. In terms of where I came from prior to joining the Wastewater Opportunity Fund, I was one of the original employees and then ultimately part of the management team for Pantheon Ventures, a very large private equity fund of funds. We grew it from a raw startup to about $23 billion under management. Over the time period of 25 years I was there, really came to market with some very innovative products. Here, all of it became best of breed, so very proud of that. So very similar to what we're trying to do here is we've seen a market niche, we think there's a great investment opportunity, let's take advantage of it. In terms of my background, in terms of on the educational side, Cornell undergraduate, I have a degree in agricultural economics, and then I have an MBA from Northwestern University.
I'm Damon Uzon, and I joined the firm in end of 2010, and really was the founder of kind of this strategy, if you will. Our firm had already been doing some work in the wastewater space, but really I had previously joined working for a real estate development company, doing very large mixed-use real estate development projects. If you're familiar with Portland, areas in the Pearl District, South Waterfront, and then downtown LA. So really buying kind of distressed, essentially neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods, and building them up from scratch, really kind of neighborhood building, but ultimately building large kind of work, live, play neighborhoods. And so all in all, that was about $2 billion worth. And a lot of the backbone of kind of what we're going to talk about today, whether we think about entitlement, development, construction, and then stabilization and disposition, is really kind of the backbone of the strategy. And so my background in terms of education, went to University of Oregon, and got my MBA at Purdue University.
Great.
Good. Kind of started.
Yeah, if we could just move down to page two here and really kind of, let's really talk about what we're doing. And this is more of an executive summary. We're going to cover a few of these points in a little more detail later on, but just to kind of get you excited and up to speed with some of the key takeaways, let's go for it. So first and foremost, we are solving a waste problem here. And we're building out a portfolio of facilities that process food, beverage, agriculture, municipal waste, and we take all this waste and turn it into revenue streams. Now, a key takeaway here
is that when we, before we make an investment in any project, we have already locked down about 70 to 90% of the revenue streams here. And they can come primarily from waste processing fees, where producers of waste or haulers pay us to take their waste. And the other big component of the revenue stream is on the energy side. And that can be electricity or fuel, vehicle fuel, so natural gas. So those are the two big revenues. Again, 70 to 90% are locked down before we even make an investment, put our money at risk.
On that point, with respect to locking down the waste hauler fee side of this model, are your targeted areas or investments outside of areas that are long-standing exclusive franchise areas where a lot of the waste stream you're talking about has already been spoken for? I'm thinking particularly here about residential, commercial, organics, food waste. As you must know, much of that waste stream throughout the state, LA, Orange, Riverside, doesn't matter, is tied up and gone somewhere else, right?
Two things. First, we're going to show you how we map an area, and we're going to do it right in this area, so one you will know very well. Secondly, all these waste processors are looking actually for a green alternative. So if you were going to go bid for a new waste contract or renew your contract at Contra Costa County or any of the cities here, you actually need to have a green alternative here. And you are now mandated by the state of California and three other states the end of last year, you no longer can take organic waste and put it into landfills here. So there is a change of what we are doing with this waste.
But just to give you a feel, the waste haulers themselves, in terms of the organic portion of the waste stream, waste management, for example, is the largest in the space. They control about 4%. So compared to other forms of waste, garbage, recycling, paper, it's very disaggregated. And so part of our strategy is working with the waste haulers, Waste Management, Ecology, Republic, in terms of aggregating that. But if we think about large forms of the waste streams, the residential is the smallest portion right now. So we're starting to think of commercial kind of waste producers, industrial food and beverage processors, for which in some cases some of the public waste haulers are taking that waste stream. But in the end, we're essentially a solution to work with them to essentially be their acceptor of the waste. Or in some cases, in California now, we're basically next generation landfill. That's kind of another way to think about. And so I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. It begets others, but
and we can.
I'm just trying to understand. How much of the business model depends on revenues from non-solid waste hauler sources? So I'm thinking POTWs, cattle farms somewhere in Podunk. What percentage of your feedstock revenue comes from non-solid waste hauler sources?
It'd probably be close to that portion would maybe be in the portfolio about 20-25%. So it's a minority piece, if you will.
So the majority piece, 75%, would come from solid waste hauling operations?
Oh, I'm sorry. That would be the 20-25%
from solid waste. That's the 25%.
That's correct. And so you think about, for example, these facilities can be co-located on municipal wastewater facilities. East Bay Mud is an example. Anheuser-Busch, for example, just up here north. Campbell Soup, Disney World, if you will. So any large aggregation of food waste in those commercial sources generating, we can essentially accept that.
But would you agree, though, that within areas, whether they be cities, counties, joint powers authorities, similar constructs, the actual waste stream itself and who owns it has already been spoken for? Do you agree with that?
Correct. It would be who controls essentially the waste hauling routes, if you will. So we want to work with them because they ultimately have to take that waste. They're going to make money on the transfer from point A to point B. And so we want to be basically that landfill, if you will, where they're going to be taking the waste. Their end of site solution. It's another way to describe it. And so,
I'm sorry.
So for example, we have a facility, it's in our pipeline in Sacramento area that's basically Atlas, Recology, and Waste Management are taking to this facility. And so they are taking it, they're getting paid
to move it from essentially their customers to this basically site. And so they can take it to a landfill, or they can take it to essentially our site, or a another competing compost site. So we're essentially kind of their, or call it their organic solution. And in some cases, states where landfill is now illegal, that is a source of, we're kind of one of the only options in that scenario.
And are you also involved in the greater Los Angeles market?
And we can kind of get into that in terms of the core areas we're going to focus in on. And there's a lot of kind of economic reasons why we're going to be focusing on what we call our regional clusters, and really just kind of the economics and the best economics that we can get in our kind of key targeted states.
Now, somebody like Waste Management looking and building their own?
Excellent question. We actually shared an intern with Waste Management last year because they are not wanting to necessarily tie up their balance sheet in what they would call greenfield development, something new that is not just moving waste. So they would rather bring us the waste, pay us to take this waste, and once we have built the plants, shown what the cash flows are off of them, they are a very attractive exit opportunity for us. They could be the buyer, but they don't really want to take the risk of buying it. It's not their business. It's not their core business here. So once it's built, stabilized, then yes, they'd be coming in to do this for us.
Jay, you know this because the intern had this background and shared it?
Yes, he did. What we were doing was mapping out different waste sites and thinking about how we may be able to work with Waste Management and other groups out there to solve this problem where they no longer can take this organic waste to a landfill. So they're having to, I hate to say scramble, but they're having to come up with some near-term solutions here as to what to do with this waste. And again, they don't want to use their balance sheet to do that. So that's why Waste Management was happy to share this intern. It was actually a full-time employee of Waste Management and came to work with us last year.
I guess part of where I'm going here is this wasn't something determined by senior people at Waste Management in your organization. This is something that came through an intern.
No.
So it started with our partnership and discussions with Waste Management's organic group. The organic team solely focused in on essentially aggregating this organic waste stream. It's a small team of five. And so the head of that group we are working closely with. Again, this is more of a strategic partnership relationship where we can essentially build facilities co-located with their transfer. We are essentially their solution to take the waste to, as well as a potential partner to take our facilities out after they've been stabilized and kind of operating. And so
at a senior level, they have agreed with this. That's where I'm going.
Well, so and just to give you a feel, their core focus is not on this. Their core focus is on, you know, the hauling routes. And it's all about the hauling routes. And so that team, small, and actually is just recently has been basically disbanded. And so Waste Management, being the larger, is basically ignoring, would be somewhat ignoring this because they have to focus on their core business.
Well, and I'm coming from, I sit on a solid waste authority. We're doing anaerobic digestion in partnership with East Bay Mud. So what's going to incentivize, you know, a franchise agreement such as mine? We've already got it in place with Republic. We're collecting green waste from restaurants, from schools. We're already doing that. We're already, you know, targeting our diversion rates that we need to meet. So we've already come up with this solution. So what would incentivize other organizations to say, you know what, we don't want to do it ourselves. We don't want the benefit of the partnership with East Bay Mud, the benefits that we have intrinsic to ours, that they're going to really want to go to you? And do you have any deals closed yet? Any deals set up, or are you still raising funding to actually move forward with this?
So the answer to kind of the last part of your question is yes, we have an active pipeline. And in fact, well, I guess we can kind of get into the presentation, but we have in the clusters, we have potential projects both in Northern California, Southern California, and that includes potential project in Phoenix, and a cluster in Phoenix, as well as in Connecticut, Massachusetts, and New York. And okay, those are kind of our first pipeline. We have probably over a pipeline of about $400 to $500 million for the projects. Again, we really want to focus in on kind of the top 20, if you will, and really focus on kind of the top five. And so, you know, a lot of people we're talking to, whether it's a municipal wastewater facility like East Bay Mud, or in Southern California, there's a large
company that basically aggregates fats, oils, and greases. Mm-hmm. They can do that themselves, and we've seen Anheuser-Busch has these on 10 of 12 of their facilities, and they have the capital to do it themselves. But we're seeing a lot of entities, large grocery store chains, other companies like Campbell Soup that says, I don't want to dedicate $20 million for a back-end solution to solve my wastewater problems. Instead, we can work with a partner like Wastewater Opportunity Fund. We can bring all the ability to essentially get it built, get it operated. We actually bring additional feedstocks in, and that additional feedstocks in provides additional revenue to the project, also more energy. And so in the East Bay Mud example, by bringing in those additional feedstocks, you're able to create that additional tipping fee revenue, mm-hmm. as well as the actual energy boost. So in East Bay Mud, they're exporting, they're generating more electricity than they need, and then they're exporting 30% back onto the grid and getting revenue. So in that case, that's about a $3 million savings. To that facility to kind of lower the cost for the ratepayer. But and so in a lot of cases in working these kind of public-private partnerships, the groups aren't necessarily commercial-minded to go out and say, okay, how do we really maximize the revenue or the opportunity for this? And can we source this contract? Can we get Pepsi distributor bottle, you know, the Frito-Lay chips to get their source? And we get that under a long-term contract and really kind of feed the system. And at the same time, it's kind of generating. So we really want to set up that host relationship, whether it's a municipal wastewater, a commercial food and beverage processor, or a large dairy operation, for example. We want to have that host relationship where it can be very beneficial to the host. And so if they're making money, if you will, whether it's a revenue share or equity share, and we are as well, we can basically maximize. Because it's a 20-year life.
And who else is doing this? Is there a competitor out there? If we invest with you, are there other companies who have a very similar model to yours that are out there trying to collect those same producers?
Yeah, so there are people doing this. There are about 225 of these on the ag side. There's about 1,000 municipal wastewater creating gas, mm-hmm. But not really kind of, I would say, commercially minded doing it. East Bay Mud is probably the best example. Most of them aren't following that suit. And then you have maybe about 100 to 200 to 300 in the food and beverage processing space. And so there's a lot of one-offs. And so people are doing this because they're not clean water compliant. They're not compliant with EPA. They need a solution and a low-cost solution. So they're figuring out, can I put it on balance sheet? And can I do it myself? And so people out there have done that, and what you're seeing, but it was maybe a lack of professionalization. And nobody is doing this of kind of, it's always onesies and twosies. And so it's been done at scale. There's, I would say, it's scale and professionalization in Europe, mm-hmm. but there's different dynamics that have really driven their market and, you know, it just very kind of different
market. And from a permitting standpoint, it sounds like you're talking about co-locating them primarily with a major producer of the feedstock, meaning right there.
That's right.
Obviously, the CEQA environment in California, which is similar in other states, makes it very challenging to do this. And so how is that factored in?
Right, and so the nice thing about the strategy of our fund is capital's coming in once all those entitlements are in place. And so we're not taking any entitlement permitting kind of, call it, development risk.
Okay, and so we're assuming someone is out there and is able to get those.
Right, that's right. So we are working ourselves kind of with our other co-development partners to move these kind of projects along and get them ready. And in cases where you have projects that we're looking at that are currently operating, and we're looking at them to essentially acquire and then expand, if you will. So those are already in place.
Okay.
And again, that's something that we're managing and kind of focused in on.
So where are you first to market as far as what you're proposing to us?
Excuse me, what was
like first to market? Who else? Who else is doing this to your scale?
Are you going
to
leave?
You the first ones doing it, or others?
We'd be the first ones at this scale. Okay. There's a lot of, I would call, one-off enterprises, one-off endeavors here in the United States. Or Anheuser-Busch maybe has like done this on 12 of their breweries here. But this is what we're seeing is a $39 billion market here. It's a We would be the first ones who would be coming in with a very sizable capital base here. What we'd be doing, again, a little bit to the answer that Damon just gave here, is really looking, if you look at the upper right-hand square here, that's a facility in Sacramento. They also have one in Davis. They're actually looking at cloning those up and down the Central Valley here. They already have long-term contracts in place with several of the waste haulers here. They see other waste coming off, whether it's dairies, food processors, fats, oil, grease consolidators up and down the Central Valley, and we'll show you a chart of that. So you can actually see where there are huge waste sheds that do not have a home for this waste right now. It's being sent to a dump. They no longer can send it to a landfill. That will be eased out over time. They need to come up with a solution. This is actually a solution that takes the waste and actually generates a profit. So everybody is kind of, it's a win-win for all parties around the table here.
And keep in mind, the food waste is the heaviest portion inside of the, for a waste hauler. And so kind of taking that out, it kind of makes their routes essentially more efficient.
Scott?
Mr. Chairman and other board members, I'm going to recuse myself from participating in the discussion or decision on this matter. And just for the sake of transparency and our public record, I represent Republic Services throughout the state of California in a variety of markets, Northern and Southern California. And at least from the initial Q&A that's been had here today, I'm feeling like the investment would affect a client interest of mine, and therefore I'm feeling suitably conflicted, and I want to avoid the appearance of any impropriety and be fully transparent and not participate. I also want to make it clear I have no material financial interest in the investments of this fund indirectly or directly, and therefore that's not the basis for the recusal. The recusal is solely because I think that the discussion and the subject matter would affect one or more of my client interests, and therefore I'm going to recuse myself.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you. Thanks. Scott, for the record, the Allied Waste fuels up its trucks with that one on the top right. So they drop off their waste there and fuel up their trucks. So they are very proud, or I think very happy with the relationship. So these, again, are very beneficial for the waste haulers.
Yeah, no, I saw that you have several of my clients' facilities identified in your graph.
I'm very familiar with that.
Yeah.
I wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Well, just keeping us on schedule in the last 10-15 minutes remaining here, but keep firing away with these questions. I really do want to make sure that we're answering this here. These locked-in revenue streams provide very stable cash flows. Those are very good for two reasons. First, it allows us to refinance these and make early returns of capital to our limited partners. Secondly, at the back end, stable cash flows are very appealing to groups looking to acquire these assets. Whether, again, as we were going through here, it's for a waste hauling firm like Republic, or at the same time, if it's a financial buyer. So there's strategic and financial buyers who like these stable cash flows. Here, again, we've mentioned it's a very large market, $39 billion, and it's it is now mandated this waste diversion, and that is the real change here. You are on top of it as being, I think, the mayor of a city here. You're on top of this, but this is already in four states and the New York City. So all in all, it adds up to a very attractive return package. It's 8% current income and a 16 to 18% net to investors. So very low risk, high return here. Just in terms of how we fit on the Equilibrium platform, and this actually, you are actually an investor in one of these funds down at the bottom, but let me start you at the top of this. I'm on page 3 here. Equilibrium Capital is 8 years old. We have over $1 billion under management right now. It's growing nicely. We do manage capital for several large public plans. here, and what we're focused on is real assets. So think of it as food, agriculture, green real estate, water, and renewable energy. And then through an investment, you have an Aether fund of funds focusing on real assets. You have an investment in the ACM Permanent Crop Fund, which is doing very well. What Equilibrium does is really is kind of the product design, then the sales and distribution, and it provides the back office. What that allows us to do is focus on investments, building the portfolio, and really maximizing the gains on those portfolios. So it really frees us up to kind of make the returns that you are looking for us to achieve. So, moving to page four, what are we doing? We first and foremost are solving a waste problem here. And let me just go through this, so just to show you the scope of the waste problem here. A dairy cow, I'm going to throw out a few statistics here. A dairy cow produces 125 pounds of waste a day here. 50% of all the food that is produced in the United States is wasted here. Only about 5% of all food waste is recycled, and about 15% of all waste in these landfills is food-based or organic-based. So we have a real problem. And to add to that, waste fees to manage this waste is growing much quicker than the CPI, Consumer Price Index.
And so we're really just talking about is kind of, again, recycling like we do with cans, glass, metal, other pieces, and we just, for some reason, you know, we just have not been focused in on recycling this food waste and other organic waste streams, and we're now heading to the point where it does make sense. Our solution in terms of what we're planning on doing is kind of the, what we'll just talk about is the lowest cost and most efficient method, and really is from the fact that it's the highest and best use. And so our food waste can go to a landfill where it would just sit. It can go to a composting facility where at some point in time, once it aerates out, creates odors, but it will create some form of fertilizer. But in fact, if it can go into our system, it will go into the system in an oxygen-free environment, and biogas is created, so we can actually extract the energy out of it, as well as get to essentially the cleaner water and the cleaner nutrients. So it's that kind of self-contained allows us to be essentially lower cost and more efficient.
Yeah. So again, we've talked about this large market here at the bottom of the page are just some of the, just the size of what we consider the top opportunities in each of these categories of food, agriculture, municipal wastewater. We are only looking to partner with five groups in each of these. So five partners, which in turn will do maybe five developments. So we're just really trying to take the creme de la creme off of here. So how does this all work? Damon just touched on it a little bit, but if I can go down to the page five and just kind of walk you through this here. I think, the key takeaway is these are long-term revenue contracts from diverse revenue streams here. So we're looking to make money across the cycle. So let's go through the cycle. If we can move down to the bottom left, where it says number one, really we're taking organic material, we're being paid to take that, that can come from animal waste, food waste, municipal biosolids here. In many cases, it's just too expensive to continue to flush down the pipe. A great example of that is Chobani yogurt, Greek yogurt here. They can no longer put any more of their yogurt waste, the cheese whey, into the pipe. The municipality is saying, no, we cannot handle it here. Again, we've talked about the waste haulers to get, if you are bidding on a new contract, you need a green alternative here, and that's really happened in the last 5 years here. Composting can only take certain amounts of these, and the you have to be in compliance with the Clean Water Act. So all of this is starting to push product towards us here. So we take this product, which we get paid for, to take. We put it in a digestion tank. It's very, very simple. We add bacteria to it, and it's very similar to making beer. It's a very basic process, off the shelf. It's been around for numerous years. Cornell, my alma mater, was one of the first, and when I was there, to have a biodigester here. So we then go, if you can go to number three here, really kind of the next revenue stream, and this is one of the other major buyers, is drivers is biogas. And we can produce electricity. We take this gas and put it through a generator. We can clean it up and put it out as vehicle fuel here. So at many of our facilities, you can drop your trash off, think of a dump truck, and then refuel with the natural gas here. And we love fleets, and we love also being next to an interstate. If you notice now, more and more on the interstate, you can buy natural gas when you're driving your truck or a car across the country. And lastly, we can also inject it into a CNG pipeline and then use that as natural gas in your one's house, whether for heating or for cooking. Here. Again, long-term revenues, CPI adjusted. Lastly, a small part of the value chain, but not one to be overlooked, is the digestate. That's what's left. And you can think of it as you have a dry digestate after you wring out all the water, and that can be used for livestock bedding or compost, or the wetter form is used as fertilizer out there. And ultimately, you actually do get cleaner water, and that's actually, we don't put any value on that at this point in time, but if it doesn't rain in California, that will have some value.
And so if we just look at slide six, this is kind of the main revenue drivers, again, that Jay had mentioned, and just really want to break these down from the standpoint that these contracts are in place before our investment. And so whether we decide on the first revenue driver being the waste processing fees, and this would be similar to a tipping fee into a landfill or a sewage wastewater processing fee that essentially we would get paid for. And again, these would be under long-term contracts. It fixed prices. And one of the things just to, when we say kind of these long-term contracts, and it's fixed, so we're not about taking kind of the spot market risk. And so we want to be able to control the cost of the inputs, or in our case, it's a revenue stream, and then the revenue stream on the output. And so it's that locked-in nature that enables our strategy, if you will. So you start thinking about exits, ability to get low-cost debt on. And so the number two revenue driver on the energy side, and we're this is unique comparison to maybe other renewable energy. This biogas can be put into essentially a combined heat and power, an internal combustion engine, a GE engine or a Caterpillar engine, and create electricity. And so wind and solar does that, but one thing how we're different is we're base load. So we're going to be doing this 24/7. We don't, like when wind and solar, they have that intermittency where basically at some point the wind doesn't blow, the sun doesn't shine, and they're unable to create electricity. And so we can solve that gap. And in fact, in certain cases, because we can solve that gap, we can get a peak pricing. And so a typical agreement that we sign, if in state of California, for example, it'd be basically 13 cents a kilowatt hour, basically scaling to 20 cents. Under a 20-year power purchase agreement, there's typically CPI inflation adjusters in there. But in some cases where we can provide during the peak time, we can get a premium up to 50% in some cases. The other component is we can store this gas. And so you can actually store it and very inexpensively in basically these tanks. And when the time's right, when you want to overproduce, you can basically feed the engine and create the electricity. And so that's a little bit different from what we've seen in other, you've seen in other maybe renewable energy electricity. The other component too is we can take that biogas and not put it in an engine and condition it. And that condition, we can then put it into a pipeline, gas pipeline, or we can utilize it on site. So we have a project that in our pipeline, just outside the Phoenix area, that just happens, there's a Kinder Morgan pipeline that basically runs through it. And that's important because we now can go to one, potentially two or three of the largest oil and gas companies and sign a 15-year contract to essentially feed that pipeline of natural gas. And it just so happens to be going in California and basically getting these long-term contracts in place at very attractive prices. And so we've seen natural gas prices kind of move around. You know, you've seen it maybe in the plus 10 at the retail rate. It's kind of the wholesale rate. It's been lower. We can be profitable at the $1.50 diesel gallon equivalent. And so, we will do either, but it really is the strength of the contract as well as kind of the additional economics from that. And then as Jay mentioned on the nutrients, we right now, and we cannot and will not lock that in until we essentially have the operational phase of our facilities. And we'll get into a little bit of our kind of regional focus, but as we can definitely build out a region of these facilities where we can aggregate more liquid and solid nutrients We can feed into the markets. Central Valley here is a great example. This is organic fertilizer, and so it will be of demand. It's just basically characterizing the right product and getting it to the right channels. Just really quickly on the slide 7 I alluded to on the our regional focus, I'm really focusing on 10 core states, and it's really just the states with the best economics. And as you would imagine, highest energy prices, it's where a majority of the people live, it's more of the animals live, and really where you kind of that concentration of all that creates an opportunity to solve a wastewater problem. And we are, you know, have identified and really focused on basically building out a regional cluster. And I'll say a regional cluster, whether it be Northern California, Southern California, in the Northeast, where so think about we build one facility or acquire into a facility to expand, and then cookie cutter four, you know, 4 to 5 of those in a region with the same partners, same teams, and we can leverage a lot of the same kind of all contracts in place. So what does that look like? If we kind of look at slide 8 in terms of an example, and so how we look at a cluster. This is just a quick snapshot of ultimately it's a 20 to 30 page proprietary feedstock analysis that we put together in understanding essentially the market or a cluster when we move into it. And so this is just a kind of a quick highlight of, for example, we're looking at two facilities, and in this case it's in the Sacramento area. Those are in those kind of blue dots. And so we just want to understand who are the generators of the space. And so that's what you're seeing in the yellow. And we want to understand, you know, what it is, you know, where is their current waste streams going, and how much. And so we look at maybe in some cases in the past that material has been going to a landfill, and those are those black dots. We've seen some of those materials go to a compost facility. Compost facility can take in some of the drier waste streams, kind of like yard waste, but it can't take some of the high liquid waste streams. It can't take, and again, it just can't take the liquid. And then you can see some of the other red dots, there's other AD facilities. And so we can understand where potentially are the best place to site these facilities to kind of strategically place them close to the sources. And so, you know, as you can see, for example, a lot of there's red dots, and some of these are dairy only, small manure facilities that can't take any additional feedstocks. And in most cases, they're operated by the farm themselves. And so really kind of unprofessionally managed, something that we're not going to focus on. But you do see some opportunities. For example, you see the one in East Bay Mud, which is kind of right there in Oakland. That's the red dot. There's actually the Anheuser-Busch facility, which is right above Fairfield. But again, it's just important for us to understand, you know, what the market looks like. And then that's really the top down. But really the bottoms up portion is really understanding the yellow dots and really understanding where are they taking their waste now, can we get a long-term contract, what's their price, and we really analyze, I'll say, the revenue density of that material. So revenue density, that could be a fat, oil, and grease can generate a lot of electricity, so maybe we don't need a high tipping fee. You know, packaged goods, so in some case we can throw the Starbucks refresher drinks that you see at the Starbucks, and we can throw it into this big trash compactor. It's got a lot of material, other material that we have to extract out, but we can get paid a very high tipping fee for that. Why? Starbucks needs a certificate of destruction and proof that it's actually being disposed of sustainably and appropriately. And so we can charge a high fee for that. Stuff gets taken out, recycled, and we can take the kind of that liquid energy out of that. And so it's kind of really understanding, and again, if we talk about risks to our strategy and what we're focusing on, where we're spending most of the time, it's feedstock. These machines need to be fed. We want to make sure there's a base level of feedstock, but we want to make sure in any region there's, call it, 8 to 10x feedstock capability that continue to feed our system. Further, if we can build these in clusters, we can start moving kind of feedstock around. And so that enables a little bit of safe, you know, a little bit of safety in numbers, if you will, in addition to the operational efficiencies that we'll get. And then in the worst case, beyond that, in terms of a failure of a feedstock generator, we can get feedstock insurance kind of in addition to that. And so, again, this is one of our kind of main focus areas that we're planning on managing. Sorry, I'm moving kind of fast, but sorry. If there's anyone who has questions, just feel free to jump in. Slide 9 is really kind of what we're talking about in terms of how we're building those clusters out. You know, we've looked at and have a pretty robust pipeline in excess of $400 million. You know, we've been in the market for over 3 years now. You know, we were founders of the Bioenergy Association of California. We're members of the American Biogas Council. And so we've been very active. We know everyone in the industry, and therefore kind of have ability to kind of work with what we think is the best of the best. And so it's really kind of building that portfolio of the 20 to 25 projects in those regional clusters. And I think that that regional clusters really helps us. We are going to be coming in during construction period. It really minimizes that ability on the, I'll say that greenfield to construction risk. And then the other component to that, we're going to be utilizing very similar on the real estate construction side, a general contractor, and in this case, they call it EPC or Energy Engineering Procurement Construction Partners, and we want to work with them from the standpoint of on time, on budget. We can push that risk onto them. They're going to be essentially the insurance backstop in working with them to make sure that we can essentially deliver in budget and on time. Just real quickly, and I'm not gonna talk too much about our investment process, but on slide 10. But again, we build a lot of relationships. We have very good proprietary deal flow right now, and we're actually working through kind of our best investments now through this process. It looks like we have in the near term about 5 to 7, and we're likely going to down select in terms of the first two that we plan on doing, likely in the Q3 timeframe, and we're basically working through that now. And if I'll just real quickly, the one of which is actually down in the Southern California that was just very interesting that we like. It's basically taking in all of the fats, oils, and greases, and so we can co-locate, get paid to essentially take. Essentially, we're the replacement for the sewage fees that he's paying, as well as essentially all the energy that we can create, in addition to aggregating more under these long-term contracts. And so that's kind of one that we see as a potential cluster. Permitting is already in place for that. So just to give you a little feel. Slide 11 is really just the breakdown of what we describe as the main risk areas that we manage. We've built out the team, and essentially these are the four main elements that we're focused in on. I alluded to talked about the cycle and stock control. We want these long-term contracts and have kind of multiple suppliers. You know, it's always the question of if one feedstock supplier goes down, it can always happen. And in those cases, we want to understand what are the implications and do we have backup. A lot of these contracts will be take or pay. But if you have a feedstock generator that's going to pay you because they can't deliver the material, you're still not going to get it on the energy side. So you really got to understand that.
One question I do have in your analysis, how much are you depending upon, in essence, the tipping fee, so to speak, where right. the producer is paying you to take away as opposed to the generation of energy or, the soil?
Yeah, so maybe I could probably ask maybe two ways. overall, the way our portfolio works out, energy is going to be about half of the revenue.
Okay.
And then the tipping fee is probably going to be at 25 to 30%.
Okay.
But this kind of gets back to the revenue density equation. And so if somebody's willing to give me fats, oils, and greases for, $10 a ton versus, manure or some kind of more diluted waste stream at $50 a ton, I'll probably take the fats, oils, and greases at 10 because the amount of energy that can be created. So these tanks are creating kind of a smoothie, if you will. And so, you got to add your protein, your base,
no,
and feedstock.
And just because early models, and I'm going off my own experience, in essence, we weren't charging the restaurants, the schools. We were just picking up their green waste because it was meeting our goals, and East Bay Mud wasn't charging us as part of our partnership because they were, of course, getting the energy on the other end. So that's why I'm concerned if you're placing too much emphasis on the tipping fee. But again, different producers have different, obviously, if they can no longer, if it's a semi-liquid that they can no longer put into the sewer system, for lack of better, wastewater, then obviously they're going to have to pay to have that taken.
And typically we try to price and understand it where if their current alternative to dump into the sewer is 15 cents a gallon, then let's model it and try to get that contract at 10.
Yeah.
And so can we be lower cost?
Yeah.
And the landfill is the same way. And so if we can be lower cost, and we can be lower cost, but give us that long-term contract, we'll do that. And so because we can kind of, we again, we can extract the highest and best use from that waste stream.
Right.
I think a key point here is we're not going to actually invest any money or build anything out until we actually know what these contracts are, know what these waste streams are. So maybe you are diverting all of your waste for free or picking it up for free. Portland Insurance is actually paying somebody that we may do something with. So we may avoid your city and go to Portland, but we'd also have Portland under a 5-year or 10-year contract here. So again, we're not putting any money at risk until we know what those are.
Yeah,
it's a very good point.
Yeah.
Well, we're on risks. There's obviously a lot of high-level labor requirement on the part of understanding each of the deals, understanding the contracts, understanding the economics, negotiating rates. How big is your organization? You have biographies of six, but I don't see anything else that describes size.
Right. So we do have a small team, and that's a team of six. A lot of the cases in terms of these contracts, if you will, on the power purchase agreement, electricity, they're, I would say, off-the-shelf agreements. And so because these are smaller qualified facilities, those specific agreements don't really require negotiations. And then in terms of some of the other contracts on the energy side, we'll likely be focusing on doing it more on a blanket stage, a blanket umbrella agreement. And so again, that's our focus. And in addition to that, we have our extended team. And so we have specific consultants or partners that we're planning on working with. So for example, we have two consultants that we've been working with over the last 3 to 4 years that are kind of solely focused in on, I'll say, maybe the front end design, kind of technical aspects, whether it's understanding the feedstock, the actual biogas production, or maybe the nutrient on the back end. And then in addition to that, we're working with two, but it will likely, expand that on the, I'll say, design and construction side. So Tetra Tech is an example. Very large public company where they can actually do the design build or the EPC contract, if you will. Veolia Water is another partner that we're working with that essentially can do the on the execution side, taking it through construction, and on the O&M side. And so the contract and kind of the and we are about those contracts and the feedstock and those elements. Those are something we can handle in-house, if you will. But it's kind of, in terms of the operational kind of boots on the ground, we're going to leverage essentially our construction and O&M partners.
It's not as many contracts, though, as you think. Again, let's go back to our model. We are looking at backing or 4 or 5 different groups out there. Each one of those, in turn, will be building out 4 or 5 plants. So it's kind of, you're doing these as modular build out here, but again, once you've climbed the mountain with the parent company in this case, then it's just a matter of, do we like the way it's progressing, and do we believe there's enough food or energy out there that we can build the other plants here. So it's only 4 or 5 different groups that we will be working with here. It's not hundreds here.
Thank you.
And then just lastly, kind of the last on the risk on the liquidity side. And so we've been doing a lot of work in developing, our debt partners. And so both talking with large insurance companies, the largest commercial banks, and some smaller banks. And you've seen some more smaller regional banks get active in the space providing debt. And so what we want to do is wring out the transaction costs, get to the low cost of debt, not too dissimilar to real estate. We want to utilize some amount of term debt and low-cost debt in these facilities. And again, the fact that we have these long-term contracts, we can get this long-term debt. And then at the end, those long-term stable cash flows will enable appropriate sales and disposition, at the end of our fund.
Do you see any competition coming to the market?
It's the there. Yes, eventually there will be, but I think we see that in kind of different ways. And in a lot of the cases, the potential competition right now is strategic partners. We want the waste haulers will eventually own these facilities, in the regions, and if it's specific to their site. And so we're going to be happy to essentially be a seller to them at some point in time. They don't have the capital to continue to develop these, but they want to own them. We know that there's a lot of larger core type infrastructure funds that would love to essentially, they like owning
bridges and all different types of, you know, maybe energy generation type plants. But because these are $10 to $60 million, they're not utility grade in their mind. They like to make investment sizes of $100 million and above. So it doesn't really fit for them. So we actually like the fact that if we can build this cluster, getting back to the cluster of, you know, 4 to 5 facilities, we have a $100 to $200 million transaction that's stabilized, and because they're looking at a 10% yield or maybe something less, and we can sell to them. And so it's interesting, I had actually got a unsolicited call from a very brand name core infrastructure fund saying that they were interested. And, you know, just kind of peeking around, I'm like, well, they're like, well, our minimum check size is $100 million. And I said, well, and it's got to be stabilized. So I was thinking, well, you're never really ever going to get into the, you know, the front end of this, and you can't do this in size. But it's a great opportunity for us to continue a discussion in terms of we can sell to them. And so we kind of see that. We've already seen that in Europe. Some of these larger infrastructure funds have bought some of these facilities in Europe. So we're kind of seeing that. And so, again, we just want to kind of stay behind those long-term stable cash flows, because if we can do that and build them in these clusters, it'll be an attractive exit option.
I don't know about the confidentiality, but do companies like Budweiser or Anheuser-Busch or Waste Management, do they look at also being a partner investing in these?
So they would, obviously in case of Budweiser, they're doing it themselves, but in terms of the kind of the partnership, if you will, more likely it'll be easiest if we kind of put together, call say at a beneficial sharing agreement arrangement. you can be the landlord. You know, you agreed to give us the waste, you know, through a pipe, co-located. We will either, you agree to buy the energy back, we'll give you a small piece called 5-10% of the revenue share of some component to align them to feed it as much as possible. And then, you know, there's right to renew after 20 years. So it's really kind of that partnership where we can kind of structure so it's a win-win.
Damon, I'm a little conscious of
time. Yeah. Okay, so just real quickly, slide 12, just again, these are short construction periods. And so what we're really talking about is ordering equipment and building tanks. And, you know, from my background in the real estate development, I love this. And the fact that, you know, these are 9 to 18 months essentially to, once everything's in place, to get to stabilization. And what that means is you get to cash flow. And so what that really means is, if we kind of look at slide 13, is kind of the overall sum of our fund and how we're projecting our fund. And it is a 7 year with a 3 1-year extensions. So we just showed it as a 10 year and what happens over that 10 years. And so what we're able to do is deploy that capital, and that's what you're seeing in the dark blue. And then in year 3, in the light blue, we're able to generate cash flow from operations that are a distribution back to our investors. And so because we're going to be doing this with mostly equity, and we'll maybe using some construction financing, what that does is once they're stabilized, we can put low-cost term debt onto these facilities, no more than 50% loan-to-value. And that can accelerate and provide a cash flow distribution back to our investors. And so that's what you're seeing in the gray. And so,
is the rising interest rate, that's hit them?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So we've assumed, good question. In our model, we've assumed essentially an interest rate of 6.5%. And we've kind of flexed it, this model. So we don't, our returns aren't that effective because we're using a low amounts of leverage until we start getting interest rates in kind of, I'll call it double digits in the 10% range. And so again, it's that low leverage, so we're not dependent upon that rate fluctuations. And so what that does is that really enables, call it year 5, our ability to return capital back to our investors without really having any dispositions. And so we're showing and projecting conservatively that we would have dispositions in years 6 through 10. And what we're, and obviously there's an ability to build and stabilize and sell these sooner, but we've showed over 6 to 10. But we've shown it, we've assumed in our model essentially an EBITDA multiple of 7x, and another term to use equivalent for a cap rate would be essentially 14 or 14.3%. And so we believe that's conservative. You know, we're seeing comps in the renewable energy, in the landfill gas space, in other waste recycling businesses being the kind of 8 to 12 times EBITDA. Multiple, and so we're being a little bit lower. It just so happens that multiple slightly lower than that, it actually doesn't really make much more sense to sell. But so even at kind of this cap rate of 14%, We believe that's conservative. We know some of the other renewable energy assets are trading at kind of single-digit cap rates. So from our standpoint, we see that as upside. But again, just trying to be conservative. And again, the on the exit side, we see both the financial buyers, who I'd mentioned, somebody like a core infrastructure fund, looking for that yield. And then on the strategic side, being in a lot of the cases, the hosts. So it can be the waste haulers. It can be the host of the municipal wastewater facility. And in some cases, those exits may be built in ahead of time. And so we like that. If the municipal wastewater says, well, I want the option to buy it at fair market value at year six, year five, that makes sense to us. And that provides us essentially the option to exit. Just real quickly, I know we're kind of short on time, but slide 14, just to quickly let you know that we have the longest track record in the industry. We worked on collectively as a team, 16 projects. Kind of in addition to that, we have a pretty strong expertise in the renewable energy, as well as in the real estate side of, of significant size. And so we're leveraging a lot of the components and expertise in those industries that have a lot of strong kind of correlation and carry over into what we're doing.
Sure. Let me just where we are in terms of our fundraising here. We are about to have our first close on $61 million. I think there's three kind of investors leading that charge. It's a medium-sized pension plan, very well known. One of the largest U.S. foundations here, and a very large U.S. insurance company. So that's that's looking to be the components of the first close. We're looking at a second close at $125 to around $150 million sometime this summer, and a final close by year end. Target fund size $150 to $250 million. It's a 7-year fund with 1-year extension. Again, just highlighting the early cash flows that come back. So it's between the current yield and the early cash flows. It's a very, very different model than a private equity or an infrastructure fund. A preferred return of 8%. Management fee is 2% of committed capital during the investment phase, and then it goes down to a cost basis, net cost basis, so net of all disposals out there. So it's a 20% carried interest. So that is the quick kind of economics of the fund here. Just briefly in summary, it's a very, very large market. It's a very fragmented market. So there's lots of opportunities to acquire feedstock under long-term contracts. We know we're getting paid before we put any capital at risk, so that does diffuse a lot or take a lot of the risk right off the table. These are, again, 20-year contracts or up to 20 years CPI adjustment. Stable cash flows allows for early return of capital, multiple exit opportunities. We have the largest track record in the marketplace, proprietary deal flow. And just to kind of come back to waste management, I don't know how senior they were, but it was that team that was working on their green or biodigestible alternative. So that was the group within waste management. So I think we're talking to the right people out there, making really good inroads here, know where our deal flow is coming from. So we're very excited about this prospect here.
Do you have any investors in this fund right now? Any new investors come in yet?
We will have 3-6 coming in on this first closing here.
And at what rate? What's your total amount of money that you've accumulated so far?
That'll be the 61. That would be the first. It's the first close that we are moving towards right now.
And we'll be at by mid-year at the $125 to $150 million range.
So you have $70 million committed right now.
61 is what we've raised to date. Yes. 61 with a very long tail here. And several of those are public.
And all have agreed to the 2% committed capital as management fee?
It's 2% on the investment period, yes. That is being signed off on by all the originals, yes, the investors to date, yes. Again, it goes down to a net cost basis after the investment period. So the overall probably fee impact is probably about 1.7, 1.8 if you were to adjust it over the 7-year life of the fund.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate
welcome.
Information.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it.
Good seeing you.